Thank you.
If I can reserve 5 minutes of rebuttal time.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
You may begin when ready.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Daniel Hall, and I'm counsel for Harry Williams in this appeal. In this appeal, the Commonwealth sought to prosecute Williams for possession of a firearm as a violent felon. In order to prove that, the Commonwealth introduced Exhibit Number 4, which was a federal conviction for possession of a firearm as a felon under 922G1.
Let me stop you just for a minute and ask a sort of an academic question that struck me as I read the record here. Let's assume we entirely agree with your argument and we reverse this case and remand it for resentencing.
Yes.
Which would be the appropriate remedy, I would suggest. The record reflects that in the PSR there are convictions for qualifying offenses that occurred within the Commonwealth of Virginia. It seems to me on remand all the Commonwealth has to do is get certified copies of one or more of those, produce them for sentencing. You still get the 5-year mandatory minimum, and we're right back where we are right now. Isn't that
Judge Hummer, what we would argue, obviously that conviction order would be admissible for more than one reason in theory, but the defense moved to prevent it from being admitted into evidence because it was not substantially similar. So we'd argue that if this court grants the remedy, that did not come into evidence.
No, but I think Judge Humphrey's point is there's other crimes, Virginia crimes, that would qualify, that the Commonwealth could put in.
And I can understand Judge Humphrey.
I'm lost to understand why the prosecutor in this case went to the federal government to get their conviction order when there's all kinds of, you know, at least based on the record I see before me, they could have, you know, walked down the street practically and got some.
Yeah, Judge Humphreys, I did notice that myself. I guess our argument here would be that he was indicted for possession as a violent felon. And so if that indictment is reversed, then it should go back at no higher than a nonviolent felon.
Well, I don't think that's the case at all, because
this
is not an element of the offense. It's a sentencing enhancement.
It is a sentencing enhancement.
So it's not like third offense petty larceny, where it's an element of the offense you have to prove, you know, a certain prior conviction. Here, it's just a matter of whether you get a minimum mandatory sentence or not.
I would have to agree with your reasoning, Judge Humphreys. I think there's a point.
Mr. Hall, let me ask you, you didn't file a reply brief, and the Commonwealth made a 5A18 argument. Can you address that?
Yes. First of all, this was precisely preserved just the way the case law asks the court to look at it. The defense says, and puts his finger, it starts at 93 in the transcript, in the appendix, he puts his finger on it. You haven't proven that the device that he was prosecuted for is the same as a device in Virginia. And the trial court took a half an hour to review the statute and listen to the somewhat erroneous argument of the Commonwealth and reached legal error. And so it was, he directly put his finger on what was wrong with the conviction order. It could never prove. The word firearm is defined in Title 44 of the code, and then it's referenced as a definition, and then in the Unlawful Act section, 922.
Well, does that argument simply boil down? I understand the Attorney General's brief to essentially be because the objection was not to the specific U.S. code section. It wasn't specifically cited by trial counsel that it wasn't sufficiently preserved, and your counter-argument is it was about as specific as you can be short of doing that, and it was close enough for government work.
And more than that, Judge Humphreys, if you look at the rules of evidence 2:202, which was in effect when this case was tried, the notice of federal and state statutes in the civil and criminal sections have been codified, and it says the court shall take notice, and it says thereof, whether specifically pleaded or not. Whether specifically pleaded or not. And the trial court read the statute again, recessed at what, 4:39 p.m., comes back in at 5:07 p.m. He read the statute.
Based on the record, do we know exactly what the trial court went back and read? I mean,
Yes. He said on page 99 of the record, I read the two statutes, U.S. and state. And
right,
look
but
at
he
it.
Didn't cite the U.S. statute number. And this is
that's true.
This is a friendly question,
yes,
counsel.
Yes, ma'am.
It's a friendly question.
Yes.
So you want to agree after she...
Could he have... I mean, he just said he read the statutes. So he
right.
could have conceivably gone in the back room and read the definitional statute.
That's correct.
He has...
Correct.
The same capability of looking at the federal code as anybody else.
Absolutely.
But I gather, follow up on that, I gather your argument is essentially that while he might have read the statute, he didn't read our case law.
Correct.
It construes those statutes to what the test is for what a substantial similarity between
correct.
Two.
And that's Judge Humphrey's precisely what I'm saying. And if he listened to the argument made by the Commonwealth at the trial, he was, to some extent, may have been led down the primrose path by that. The Commonwealth did not address the 30 years worth of case law on that point.
So, counsel, one other question that you might not have thought about, but we have to think about it in every circumstance, and that is whether something can be harmless error. In light of the pre-sentence report being in the record, and in light of the fact that this is not an element of the offense, what is your response to a harmless error analysis here?
Well, for one thing, this is novel. I've never seen it approached with a federal statute, and so this court should consider giving this remedy to instruct further litigants on substantial similarity. Secondly, the Commonwealth never asserted that it was harmless error, so that hasn't been raised, and I understand that the court might reach that conclusion.
Well, Judge Decker's point is that there's a statute that requires us. If we identify error, we have to determine if it's harmless or not.
And I understand, but in this case, he was indicted for something that their evidence could never prove. And we'd say that that amounts to a form of manifest injustice, and that's why even if 5A18 could somehow bar this, we would ask the court to invoke the ends of justice.
Okay. The bottom line answer to Judge Decker's question, it would seem to me, would be that your answer would be that you cannot take something that happened in the dispositional aspect of the case and superimpose it over the adjudication aspect of the case.
Well, I'm basically saying that it was not harmless error in this case because he was indicted for something and that wasn't proven, even though it's a sentencing element.
I don't think you answered my question.
He answered it, just not the way.
Yeah.
Okay.
No.
All right, go ahead, counsel.
That would be my answer.
I think Judge Alston wants an answer to his question.
I understand. If you could repeat one more time what.
Essentially, the argument has been suggested that the circumstances that provided information in the pre-sentence report would, if had presented at the adjudication stage, accomplish the Commonwealth's objective of proving its case. But your position, obviously, would be that we can't take something from the sentencing aspect, the dispositional aspect of the case, and superimpose it on the adjudication of the case, thereby saying that an element that wasn't proven in the adjudication can't be proven in the sentencing.
And Judge Alston, thank you for clarifying it. Yes, that is my answer, because they have to prove, using a certified true copy of a prior conviction at that adjudication stage, and those things in the pre-sentence report, they would have to obtain them and I would say prove it at the adjudication stage. That's what I'm saying.
Well, is a sentencing enhancement, does that have to be proven at the adjudication stage, or can the Commonwealth put it on at any point?
I would say that based on this indictment, it should be done at the adjudication stage.
Okay. Counsel, you still have some time left for rebuttal. You want to save that, sir?
I do, thank you.
Thank you, sir. You're about 7 minutes.
Good morning. May it please the Court, Elizabeth Fitzgerald on behalf of the Commonwealth. And the defendant's argument.
Let me stop you, Ms. Fitzgerald, before you get too far into this, because I noticed you didn't address the merits of this at all in your brief. You essentially put all your eggs in the 5A18 basket. Are you basically conceding that if we were to get to the merits, the Commonwealth has got a pretty infirm legal position here?
Other than, Your Honor, with respect to the fact that the Commonwealth, of course, does bear the initial burden to prove substantial similarity, these things are alike in common core characteristics. Substantially similar.
Does it meet our definition of substantially similar from the case law?
Yes. Well, so, Your Honor, in Mason...
Can you be convicted of conduct in one statute that you can't be convicted of in another? Isn't that a problem?
I think, Your Honor, the silencer in particular is particularly damning to that analysis.
I think everything except A, basically, in the federal statute is separate, is different from what's in our statute, isn't it?
Well, I think that the silencer really is the only...
Explosives and other such. I don't think our statute mentions those either.
Well, so the of course, none of this is particularly necessary to reach the issue in this case. But in Armstrong, when the court goes through and talks about how firearm is not defined in that statute, but it has been defined in other aspects of the Virginia Code to include things up to and including the frame or receiver of a firearm, of a handgun, the firearm statute does include explosives if you read it.
But counsel, you didn't make any of these arguments on brief, and I think Judge Humphrey's question is, since you did not make a merits argument on brief, is it safe for the court to assume that the Commonwealth is conceding the merits?
Yes, Your Honor, and I understand that that is a direct question, and I'm not trying to be evasive. My response to that is that under this court's case law, most recently in Mason, the court talks about the Commonwealth has the burden first to show that these are largely alike in substance, their essentials share common core characteristics. And if you do that, the burden shifts to the defendant to show dissimilarity by showing that you could be convicted under one statute for a crime that is not a statute, for a offense that would not be a crime under the other statute. In this case, I think these two code sections on their face are alike in common core characteristics. They both do criminalize the possession of a firearm by someone who has been convicted of a felony. Had the defendant raised the specific issue that he's raising on appeal today, which is that federal code section, 18 U.S.C. 921, defines firearm differently, I believe he would have been able to show dissimilarity. However, that was not the argument that was made by the defendant at trial.
But you didn't make that argument on brief.
I did.
I mean, you made it in the context of a 5A18.
Yes, Your Honor. So I don't believe that those two can be divorced. I think on the record that we have, I have a merits argument. However, if the proper
let me try something else.
Sure.
If we believe that it was preserved under 5A18,
then I lose. Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
I don't have a backup argument other than that.
I just wanted to make sure.
Yes.
We understood your argument.
Well, let's talk about the preservation. I'm going to read specifically or directly from the transcript. At trial, the appellant made the argument 922G1, quote, covers a wide range of devices that Virginia does not cover, and appellant being a felon, and if he's convicted of possession of a firearm by a felon in federal court for a bow and arrow, let's say, for a device that mimics a firearm, we're not sure if that is similar to what we have here today. Now, I'm not saying that that is the most precise way of saying it, but it does raise the issue, and the let's say suggests to me that he's using the bow and arrow as an example of a lot of things that could apply. Why didn't it put the trial court on notice that a critical analysis of the statute was required before it could make the determination in this case?
Well, Your Honor, I think specifically, and the argument that's been specifically advanced on appeal, is that a separate code section, a separate federal code section, controls this issue because a separate federal code section defines what a firearm is. This trial judge was never asked to consider the federal definition of a firearm under that code section. He had no opportunity to intelligently consider what a firearm is under the federal code. All he was given was the code section on the conviction order, which I would disagree with the characterization of the record that the trial court looked at multiple federal code sections.
Didn't the court have to do that in order to determine substantial similarity? How do you do that without looking at whatever the source material is? I mean, in Virginia, for example, firearm is not defined by statute. It's defined by Armstrong, by our Supreme Court. So, I mean, you have to look to the reference sources, basically, in some cases to find out, you know, what you're talking about.
Certainly, Your Honor. In this case, the trial court did look at the federal code section that this defendant was convicted under. He says on Appendix 99, upon reading the statute, the federal statute. So he did look at that particular code section. However, it is on the defendant when he wants to rely on a definition found in another U.S. code section that he needs to bring that law to the trial court's attention. And while the court can take judicial notice under the recent Supreme Court case law in Williams, it has to be apparent on the record that it did so. In this case, there is nothing in this record to demonstrate that the trial judge was aware of that separate federal code
section. But isn't the purpose of 5A18 to alert the trial court as to the issue and for the Commonwealth to have an opportunity to respond? Here, the issue of substantial similarity was raised. The Commonwealth responded, albeit we could debate what that response, the value of that response, but the Commonwealth responded. The trial judge not only had the opportunity to consider it, but went in the back for a half hour and did something, looked at the federal code section or whatever the judge did, came back and ruled. Isn't that the whole purpose of 5A18?
Your Honor, the defense has to raise the argument with specificity. This court held in Edwards that making one legal argument on the same
point. But isn't the specificity, this is not a substantially similar statute.
Yes, Your Honor. However, I think it does fall under the Edwards line of cases, and also West Alexandria properties from the Supreme Court, where it says the defendant cannot take the same position but rely on reasons that were not advanced for the benefit of the trial
Edwards
court.
But Edwards specifically says a general argument or an abstract reference to the law is not sufficient to preserve an issue. This wasn't an abstract reference to the law. As I understand it, trial counsel was trying to tell the judge that we have to look at the statutes, we have to compare them, we have to make a critical analysis as to whether or not they can be used for this particular prosecution, essentially putting the court on notice that the court has to make a fundamental determination as to the applicability of this statute for the purpose of this conviction. What more?
And in order to make that analysis intelligently, to intelligently consider the issue, the trial court needed to have been aware of this separate federal conviction.
You're losing me, Mr. Sherrill. It seems to me, you know, if it's sufficient to say objection hearsay without having to recite every exception that does not apply, if it's simply sufficient to raise the legal objection and say this evidence should not be admitted because it violates a general rule of evidence, why isn't it specific enough to say, Judge, we object to the admission of this conviction order because this offense is not substantially similar to Virginia law, essentially on the subject. If you know, without saying more than that, isn't that enough to put the trial court on notice to the effect of this should not come in because whatever the conduct is that's at stake here is not the same. You know, it's not sufficiently congruent with conduct in Virginia that would be equally criminal. I mean, you know, what more does the trial court need to know to be on notice of something like that?
Well, certainly, Your Honor. However, the Supreme Court case on this issue is clear that the defendant cannot rely on reasons on appeal that weren't advanced for the benefit of the trial court. And
what reason is he relying? Saying it's not similar.
Certainly.
What more does he have to do except to say it's not admissible because it's not similar? Doesn't the burden now shift to the Commonwealth to establish that it is?
Well, Your Honor, I would argue that that when he wants to rely on that federal definition on appeal, and I think that is critical to the resolution.
The Commonwealth
is
relying on it. The Commonwealth is saying it's substantially similar. The trial court agreed. You basically conceded its error. It was error for it to do so, it seems to me. Now,
the
question is, should it more have been done to put the court on notice that it was error to do so? And I'm struggling to understand that because, frankly, you're objecting to the admission of a document by saying it doesn't meet the legal test of the statute. What more do you need to tell the trial court other than, you know,
that? The defendant didn't give the trial court a valid reason why it didn't meet the test.
It wasn't substantially similar. If it's not substantially similar, it's not relevant, is it?
So the defendant essentially said these are not substantially similar because the two examples he gave did not prove that these were dissimilar elements, and he did not argue the specific statute to trial court.
So your argument would suggest that the defendant in making the argument, if I'm miscasting your argument, please correct me, would have had to make the argument that it made at the trial court and also say, if you take a look at section 921A3, that also would suggest that it would not apply to this case. In other words, give a specific reference to the definitional statute in the federal code.
I think that when you're arguing to a trial court that two terms of art are defined differently, you have to give him the definitions to work with in order to make your argument.
But that's inconsistent with Lash v. County of Henrico and Asphaw v. Commonwealth, which says you don't have to cite specific code sections or statutes as long as the judge is aware of the challenge, of the legal challenge. And the legal challenge here was very clear.
I think when the language of the code section forms the basis of your argument, certainly you do need to make the trial court aware of a code section so that the court can take judicial notice, for example, of that.
So if all the Commonwealth has to do is offer something and the defense is now required to affirmatively disprove that it's admissible, that they can't just object and state a basis for objecting. They have to put in the record all of the evidence that supports their position.
To go back to the court's hypothetical about hearsay, if you say objection hearsay and the court says, okay, how is this hearsay? I mean, and the answer here in that context was two things that were not actually true.
If my answer is it's not a court statement made by someone other than the declarer offered for the truth of the matter asserted, which
great,
is the legal definition of hearsay, am I done?
Or
I still have to go on and explain why every exception does not apply?
Well, Your Honor, if on appeal your answer turns into, no, it's an excited utterance, then I think you do have a problem, and that's what we have here. We have him taking the same position, but advancing different reasons for the same position. And that is precisely what this court does not allow under 518 and what the Supreme Court does not allow under 525.
So you would say if they argued at the trial level it was an excited utterance, and then when you come up on appeal they say it's a statement against interest, that issue is whether or not a statement against interest was not placed before the trial judge. The trial judge ruled on the predicate of an excited utterance and not on this other exception or exemption to the hearsay rule.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. All right. Interesting. We've really gotten you off your game, haven't we?
No. I mean, I think it is.
How about harmless error? You want to talk about that?
I think it's the crux of the issue, certainly.
You're welcome to talk about harmless error.
Yes, Your Honor, and we didn't brief harmless error, obviously. The court is aware of that. I'd be happy to submit additional authority on that regard, but the court noted you do
have think it's harmless
statutory
error.
Obligation to look at it. In candor to the court, I'm not sure that you can take something from the pre-sentence report that wasn't put into evidence in this case necessarily. So if that had been, if they'd all been offered, certainly I would have a stronger harmless error argument.
We understand that there's a reason you didn't argue harmless error.
Sure,
Thank you.
And if I'm wrong in that regard,
well, I can help you out a little bit because I actually looked into that a little bit, and I think you would have been safe up until the statute, because Odell versus Commonwealth does say that anything that's in the pre-sentence report, if not objected to, can be considered at sentencing by the trial court. The problem I think the Commonwealth has, and mm-hmm. why I think your instincts are good and you're correct, is the General Assembly, when they enacted the bifurcated trial statute 295.1, specifically said the Commonwealth shall present the defendant's prior criminal history in the form of certified, attested, and exemplified copies of final orders. So that kind of takes it out of the realm of looking at the PSR, it seems to me.
That makes me feel a little better.
It was your instinct to say that you were correct.
Great. However, I would urge the court to not reach that issue, because the Commonwealth's position is that this matter has been barred by 518, and I've
That's the thin reed you're clinging to
assuming
here.
Assuming we disagree with you on 518, what would you suggest is the remedy in this case?
The remedy would be, I think the remedy might be a remand for a new trial, Your Honor, because this is an evidentiary issue. It was framed specifically in the assignment of error.
Well, let me ask you about that, because it's not an element of the offense. It's a sentencing enhancement. So in other words, I struggle to understand how it would be at all relevant on the issue of guilt or innocence on the elements of the underlying offense. It's only relevant in terms of whether the 5-year minimum mandatory sentence applies. And to that extent, it's purely an issue of resentencing. And as I pointed out, out of the box here, it seems to me that I don't know why the Commonwealth did what it did at trial. I know you weren't there, but it seems to me we could have avoided this entire argument. We just wasted a lot of taxpayer money having this discussion today if we send it back for resentencing and all the Commonwealth has to do is walk to another courthouse and get a certified copy of one of the qualifying convictions that are in the pre-sentence report and not even have to refer to District of Columbia law or anything. So.
Yes, and I'm not sure the particular rationale for the orders that were relied on in this case.
Well, and Mr. Hall very candidly acknowledged that this is the best he gets is a resentencing out of this under the existing law.
Mm-hmm. I think either way.
Much ado about nothing, apparently. So.
Well, I don't think it's nothing probably to Mr. Williams. Or to the Commonwealth, and obviously our position would be that you don't have to do any of this because, again... 518 precludes the shown appeal.
All right.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you,
Ms.
Farrich.
Ms. Jerome.
I'm just going to say thank you for considering the matter, and I ask you to grant the remedy.
Thank you.
We always appreciate when lawyers kind of know if they've got a decent hand and are able to throw it.